Hello, and welcome to episode 81 of the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast. When Three Become One, Part 1. The last time we looked at Bosnia, we stopped the timeline at the start of 1996, when Dayton was just coming into effect, and explained a little of what the footballing outlook of the nation was going to be, and why, initially at least, that would be pretty confusing. We touched on this back in our episode wrapping up the Bosnian War, but it's time to go into quite a bit more detail on how Bosnia and Herzegovina, and eventually the Republika Srpska, decided that the peace, albeit a fragile one, needed a bit of give from all sides. As we mentioned in that episode, football initially began with three separate entities. The First League of Herceg Bosnia, covering the ethnic Croat areas, the Prva Liga Republika Srpska, covering the Serb areas, and the Prva Liga Bosnia I Herzegovina, covering the rest of it. While in 2023 Bosnia has one top tier that covers the entire nation, that the second tier and beyond is regionalised isn't an economic thing, it's very much an identity thing. And it's perhaps best for an observer not to think of the Bosnian league system today as a pyramid, but rather as two separate pyramids that has a little table at the top, balancing it, almost akin to the NBA having East and West leagues with a unified playoff system. The Bosnian Premier League today is, sort of, the playoffs. And to explain all that, we need to go back to the Bosnian War and open up the Dayton Agreement that ended it. When we think of Bosnia today, we should really think about two entities: Bosnia and Herzegovina, aka the Bosniak and Croat areas, and the Republika Srpska. We end up with three leagues at the start of the nation, not by design of Dayton, but because, mainly, the Croat League had gotten started in 1993 rather than 1995, and, as such, things had been set up in all areas to keep the regional league systems apart from each other before Dayton brought the nation together. But it's important to look at Dayton not in the sense of what it is, but rather to look at it at what it isn't, because the nature of it is that it's very easy to poke holes in. Prior to Dayton, 34 separate plans to try to bring the Bosnian War to an end had been attempted. What Dayton therefore wasn't was some sort of grand plan that had been in the works for ages to solidify the future of a nation. It was simply the progression of one being one of multiple attempts to get people to stop killing each other, and happened to have the good fortune to be the one that actually stood the test of time. Even then, it only got over the line because the negotiators wielded the stick by more or less locking the Bosniak representatives in a room and telling them that the US would pull all support if they didn't sign it. But a cursory look at a map shows that it was clearly an imperfect solution. You have, for example, the Posavina Canton, which is part of Bosniak Croat area in practice, but is also an exclave separated from the rest of those areas by the Republika Srpska. The Pojedinje Canton is almost similar, almost entirely surrounded by the Republika Srpska, save for a single road link. In short, you have geographical, administrative and ethnic regions whose existence is entirely based upon everyone continuing to get along. One of the key criticisms of Dayton is that it has entrenched a negative peace in that, while there is no open conflict, the reasons behind the conflict it ended haven't actually been tackled all that much, hence why you still have international troops on the ground from the EU to assist the maintenance of the peace. By essentially just writing the differences between the regions into law and building an administration around them, one could argue that Bosnia is merely in a state of frozen conflict, almost like North and South Korea, and that, without continually international involvement on the ground, a flare-up of conflict is, at some point, inevitable, and that, by writing the regions into law rather than the nation into law, but it also suggests, potentially, that the nationalism that drove the war, in the first place, hasn't been tackled. Instead, it was rewarded. Certainly, no external force to date has ever fully withdrawn from the nation and sought to test just how solid the peace is. As we'll touch upon when we get to dealing with Kosovo once again in a few episodes' time, one of the key priorities in the Balkans has been in maintaining things in a state of peace rather than risking aggravating anything in trying to sort a lasting solution. Dayton has lasted because so much has been invested in maintaining it, rather than things being put into a state where the peace maintains itself. Hence why, when we talk about things that feel more complicated than they should be, and we certainly will do that, this is why. Dayton is a complex deal to arrange peace for a time, not a complex deal to ensure peace building in perpetuity. But the world has seen maintaining an imperfect peace as preferable to risking the creation of a more perfect one. But some of the problems that Bosnian football would eventually inherit were ones extremely familiar to long-term listeners. When the Bosnian Premier League began in 2000, as the first season incorporating all of the sides from the Croat and Bosniak regions of Bosnia and Herzegovina, it had a quite incredible 22 sides, going down to 16 the following season, then rising to 20 the season after due to the inclusion of sides from the Republika Srpska, before settling at 16 sides, which would hold until the mid-2010s. In this episode, we'll go from the setting up of the regional leagues to the creation of the national pyramid, and next time, we'll go through the first few years of that, as well as the national team, before dropping Bosnia off in the 2010s, as international success gave way to strife. One bit of housekeeping for names, first of all. For this episode, I'll be referring to the various FAs by their ethnicity, which means that for the purposes of this episode, the NFSBIH, aka the Bosnian FA, will be referred to as the Bosniak FA, given that, until the end of this episode, they aren't properly representing the entire nation. It's an inelegant solution, but one that will resolve itself, and I hope you understand that for simplicity's sake, I've chosen to try and make things as unconfusing as they can be for you. As with Dayton imposing unity on Bosnia, so too did we see with UEFA imposing it upon football. Ultimately, only one set of sides could play in European competition, with UEFA unwilling to permit Bosnia to operate as per the UK in European competition with multiple entrants from multiple pyramids from the same nation. These negotiations between leagues were, however, pretty torturous, with the planned date of league unity having to be repeatedly pushed back and some sort of initial solutions ending up with issues of their own because of ethnic strife. A good example of this would come in 1999, when the qualification of Velez to the final stage meant that the plan to host games in Mostar led to fallings out between the Croat and Bosniak leagues, given the precedent from the season prior to host the end-of-season playoff games in neutral venues, and that, given the relationship at that point between Velez and Zrinjski, nothing in Mostar could be brought forward to actually host games. Certainly the who plays where in Mostar issue has been one of the most intractable since the Bosnian War, and one where the frozen state of things has led to an inelegant and pretty unsatisfying compromise. So, without further ado, and I appreciate there's been 8.5 minutes of ado so far, let's jump into the regional leagues, starting with the Croat Top Flight, the first league of Herceg Bosnia. 50 clubs would be involved in this system all in all, with some rather odd combinations, such as there being 4 clubs in Mostar, the region's biggest urban centre, compared to 10 in Orasje, which, well, isn't. Many of these clubs are already lost to history, such as Redaš Svenik Mostar, the club of the police, Vatski Granica of Ravno, the club of the border guard, who lasted under a year, or Deventer 103, a club in exile from Deventer, who took their name from the Croat regiment that helped resurrect the club. With a league club for around every 10,000 people in the region, it's easy to see why the Croat region's league was unsustainable and uncompetitive. 17 sides played in the first season of 93-94, and, unlike previous introductions to the leagues, we won't go through all of them, and instead introduce 2 that we need to, and 2 in passing. The ones in passing are Gosk Gabela and Posušje, both of whom still hang around the top flight to this day. Gosk go back to 1919, having been formed by two returnees to the town from Mostar, and, for a time pre-1939, were the local footballing arm of Stjepan Radic's peasant party, before taking its current form in 1958, failing to get above the fifth tier before the Bosnian War. Posušje, meanwhile, go back to 1950, and were known prior to the war as NK Bauxit, after the local bauxite mine. As a sign of how they were playing through war, for most of the time in the league, they couldn't play at their home stadium, as it had been commandeered as a helicopter base. Posušje would win the final two editions of the Croat League in 1999 and 2000, but faded into chaos rapidly when the leagues united, once going through 13 managers in under two seasons. The two clubs to mention in depth are, of course, Zrinjski Mostar and Soroki Brijeg, two clubs who are absolutely joined at the hip. Given Soroki Brijeg's history is kind of based upon local fans wanting a closer tribute act to Zrinjski, it makes sense to start with the Mostar side. Zrinjski, like so many clubs, came out of the Sokol system, but rather more subtly than others in Yugoslavia. The idea for a club had reached Mostar in 1895, but it would take a decade for those behind the local sports society to actually be allowed to set up the entity we know as Zrinjski in 1905. They would merge with local rivals Hrosk in 1917 and become Herzegovac. They would become Zrinjski in 1922 as a rebuke to Serb officials who were trying to make the club change name to JSK Mostar, Yugoslav Sports Club. Zrinjski would eventually dominate pre-World War II Mostar football against rivals JSK, who were obviously set up in reaction to Zrinjski not calling themselves JSK, Velez and Vardar. Zrinjski would be involved in the Ustasha Croat League during the war, and, like anyone who was involved in that, the club was swiftly dissolved at the end of the war and documents about them burned. With Zrinjski being the most high-profile club in the region who had taken a part under Tito, as well as them holding a rivalry with Velez since before 1939, memories of the club continued, and in 1992 the club came back to life as a touring side playing friendlies until the Croat League kicked off in 1994. Soroki Brijeg are perhaps best thought of as a reaction to 1945. Football came to the city after Mostar, primarily thanks to the work of Father Dominic Mandic, one of the most fascinating figures from the region and one I do recommend having a look into. But it didn't result in the formation of a club until after the end of World War II, when FK Borac was founded in 1948. They would become Mladost Soroki Brijeg in the late 1950s and stay that way, topping out in the third tier of Yugoslav football in the 70s. They would win the first five Croat regional league titles. Much like Zrinjski, they were and are an overtly Croat nationalist side, but came without the pre-war baggage that allowed them to compete in the socialist era and was the source of the judged lack of representation of Bosnian Croats that sparked the club's very formation in reaction to Zrinjski being unformed. As we reached 1998, UEFA's edict that only one league could have European spots took full effect, and, as a result, the Croat League allied with the Bosniak League to set up post-season playoffs for those spots, as the top four Bosniak sides and the top two Croat sides split into two groups of three, with the winners of each mini-group becoming the Bosnian champion. That they would be the very first steps of footballing rapprochement made sense, given that the Croat League predated Dayton, but that Dayton saw the Croat and Bosniak administrative regions work as one, with the country really split into two units, one covering those areas and another covering the Republic of Srpska, with bits of the overarching state reaching out to both regions with differing levels of success and differing levels of involvement or interference from external parties. So before jumping into the Bosniak League, it's time to explain about those external parties. Specifically, the Office of the High Representative. The High Representative is the highest political power in the country, and is a direct result of Dayton, being an international appointment made by major international powers, and whose powers were refined after Dayton in 1997 in a meeting in Bonn, resulting in what are known as Bonn powers. Originally, the High Representative was basically a reporting officer to aid the implementation of Dayton. Once Bonn powers were introduced, they became a vetoing position who can override local wishes to get things done if other parties were seen as being obstructive or sitting on their hands, and to also sack politicians if need be. We'll get into some of that a little bit more in the next episode. These Bonn powers would be used, and arguably abused, for almost a decade until the role became less the preserve of the wider international community and more an EU-controlled role, who appointed people that had a stake in improving the relations in Bosnia in preparation for a hoped-for accession to the EU. Arguably, that relationship has strained more recently with the current High Representative, given that the current appointee, Christian Schmidt, is the first holder of the role to not have had extensive experience in the region prior to his appointment, and that he has arguably been the most involved in directly impacting the direction of politics in the nation since the era of Paddy Ashdown, who used Bonn powers regularly to strengthen central state instruments. So, UEFA's actions in forcing things together make sense in the grand political scheme of things. External interests in Bosnia have a tendency to be either focused on strengthening the state or attempting to rip it apart, and making the leagues play nice with each other was definitely a part of the former of those interests. As it came to the Bosniak League, where the Croat League was impacted by the effects of war, the Bosniak League had to be played in an active war zone. The first season of 94-95 saw the league as four regional groups playing only occasionally. For the larger groups, that meant playing a total of five league rounds with no games played between the end of September and mid-April, and familiar sides forced to play in unfamiliar places, not least Cesnica and Sarajevo, who couldn't play in Sarajevo for obvious reasons. Much like in the Croat leagues, it suffered from a large amount of unsustainable sides. For example, the Sarajevo group in that first season was won by Zmaj od Bosne, who no longer exist, with the Tuzla group featuring a club called Natron Maglaj, Natron meaning baking soda, after a local company. The format was akin to an old Champions League format. Groups fed into a single leg playoff round, which fed into a final group stage that would be won in that first season by Šerik Sinica, a familiar name at least. No baking soda there. The league would then eventually go into a 16-side normal league format, and Šelik would win all three titles prior to the communion with the Croat leagues, from which point Sarajevo clubs would take over in the run-up to the first truly national league in 2000. But this part can't pass without a mention of Velez. Prior to the Bosnian War, you could make a fair argument that Velez were perhaps Bosnia's most successful club. While Sarajevo and Zelje certainly beat them in terms of a trophy cabinet, no other side in the Republic had been able to maintain the consistent level of relevance as Velez had over fully three decades from their first title push in 1962-63, and I think most people would argue quite fairly that the era of the BMV in the 70s probably saw Velez as the best generation of any Bosnian side of the Yugoslav era. However, that entire period of success was with them as masters of Mostar, a city they didn't share. The revival of Zrinjski was another matter entirely, and the wars had made that a much greater issue. Velez's socialist era stadium, Bijelim Bjegom, is on the western side of the Neretva river that bisects the city. As the Croat-Bosniak war raged in the middle of the Bosnian War, and Mostar famously became the front line of that, that western side of Mostar became the Croat side of the city. As the ideological wars carried on, Velez's history as a left-wing anti-fascist club bounced up against the Zrinjski that were overtly nationalist, overtly Croat, and are accused to this by some to this day to be overtly Ustasha. The city's division between clubs spilled over into a division between nationalities and ideologies. Bijelim Bjegom changed over the period from being a casualty of war, as Velez's administration building containing all their trophies and archives was destroyed, into a, into one of the spoil into a center of war, being used as a holding camp for non-Croats during that conflict, into being one of the spoils of war, as it was usurped by Zrinjski. With Dayton having embedded the frozen conflict rather than being a proactive peace, nowhere was the peace chillier than in Mostar, and Zrinjski's usurpation of the stadium translated into a reality where matters were too fraught to consider the possibility of the distinctly non-Croat Velez moving back to their historical home. In 1995, the Zvracici Stadium would be built to house Velez, moving to its current name of the Radeni Stadium in 2017. No proposal for Velez to ever move back into their old stadium has ever really gained traction, in spite of general support from it from many in the footballing community, and over 30 years on from Zrinjski's initial occupation of the stadium, it seems fairly likely no proposal ever will. All of that leaves us with just the Republika Srpska remaining. The Republika Srpska FA was set up in 1992, and the first priority of it was not to set themselves up as a league, but as a nation, initially playing a friendly against a side formed from the Krajina, before setting a league up in 95-96 to follow a cup competition. This national side would play a few more times before the absorption into the Bosnian FA initially against the Krajina, but then, once that was no longer possible, against club sides, most notably playing Bayern Munich in 2001. FIFA wouldn't allow them to play any competitive games, and, as noted earlier, UEFA stopped them playing European games, so an eventual merger with the NFSBIH would have to come, eventually happening in 2002, and thereby ensuring there would be one Bosnian National League and one Bosnian National side. When it came to those regional league matters, Borac was surprisingly not able to assume the dominance that other sides in the regions had, particularly given that the Banja Luka side had been playing in the Yugoslav League in the interim. The league was also, at first, overtly political, containing as it did a Republika Srpska version of both FK Sarajevo and Zelenikar. The two would merge with each other in 1997, before the pretendy clubs disappeared in 1999. The pre-unification editions of the league would be dominated by Rudar Ugljevic, who could perhaps be thought of as a Republika Srpska version of Serbia's Obilić, in that the club was ably assisted by a fan who also happened to be a paramilitary commander in Mando Maksimovic. Rudar would eventually try to name their stadium after him, and UEFA had to step in to stop that. Save for Borac, who we have, of course, come across quite a bit previously, the Republika Srpska wouldn't be responsible for another consistently prominent club. Why? Well, the Republika Srpska's joining of the wider Bosnian system was from a different motive than that of the Croat system. For one, the Croat League, FA, and on broader terms, ethnic region as a whole, generally got stuck into the task of nation building, and UEFA's decision around European competition simply was the catalyst for the joining of the leagues that would have happened anyway at some point. There was an expectation that, had they not chosen to join, the Republika Srpska clubs and, by extension, their interests would have been left behind. And while the conjoining of the Croat and Bosniak system wasn't without its issues, such as playing games in Mostar as we mentioned earlier, UEFA's decision merely accelerated a process that would probably have happened in the couple of years following their decision anyway. If the Croat League merged into the Bosniak League because of a fear of being left behind, the Republika Srpska League joined because of the reality of being left behind. Active discussions between the unified Croat-Bosniak FA and the Republika Srpska FA had begun in early 2000, likely not all that coincidentally after the end of the Kosovar War and the beginning of the end for Slobodan Milosevic. But negotiations were difficult, and for 2 years the Republika Srpska FA basically dragged things out as long as they could, missing deadline after deadline to join, while the standard of their league dropped through the floor. The 20-team league system in the 2002-2003 season, the first with all three regions playing as one, saw six teams from the Republika Srpska. Lietar Trebinje would win the league that season. The five other Republika Srpska sides would either be relegated or finish within 3 points of the relegation spots. Their competitiveness had been destroyed by staying apart. Bosnian club football, like the nation itself, had been put together into an uneasy alliance. Next time on the history of Yugoslav football, we move matters across to the national team, and to the FA, and to a bit of Republika Srpska as well, in our final Bosnia episode, as things settled down, but then UEFA make one more move that would redefine how Bosnian football would operate, and potentially ruin it. So yeah, that is part one done. It is a two-part finale for Bosnia this time around. That is being written. I do hope and kind of expect that I will have it out in 2023, and that will come with a as a companion the sort of primer for Bosnian football now, because a lot of the things we're going to discuss in the second part of this Bosnia finale are things that sort of go beyond a bit, so it makes sense to release those. Probably they will come out more or less at the same time, I think. We'll see about that. But yes, you'll be glad to know there's a script for the next episode already has the words Vico Zeljkovic in it, which, if you are a follower of Bosnian football, is a name that will rightly bring you out in hives. So yes, there are a couple of Bosnian things to make you aware of if you've not already been aware of these, if you've not already had a read of them. In this month's edition, the December 2023 edition of World Soccer, was an article from Alec Macquarie, which yours truly has helped a bit with, which is about the Mostar Derby and football in Mostar in general. Very interesting read, and you know, great to see. Four pages just going on about the stuff I go on about, really, in such a esteemed publication. If you've not also seen, there was a recently, I think, probably start of last week, as for when I'm recording this, an investigation by the outlet Josimar, I think it's just Josimar Football, the website for that, which is into the actions of a certain Mr. V. Zeljkovic, and about Bosnian pitches, which doesn't sound interesting, I'm sure, an article just about building pitches, but I promise you, it's been one of the big controversies in Bosnian football over the past couple of seasons, and it really does, you know, go well into, go deep into that particular issue. So yes, we'll be doing that. Then, after all the Bosnian stuff, there's got one Macedonia episode to do, and X amount of Serbia / Montenegro / Kosovo episodes to do. I say X amount because that's a that one's up in the air as to how many I need to get through when writing those particular scripts. But yes, the end is nigh. And then, not probably at some point before the end of this year, there'll be just a talking about the winter breaks and stuff. And there's also the Euro 24 draw as well. There's so much going on in football in the region at the moment, and it is hard to keep up with, isn't it, a little bit? But please do keep listening to this, and I'll try as best I can to keep you reasonably informed in what's going on in the region, which leads me only to the sort of stuff that we always do at the end of the episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, sharing is caring. Please say to your followers on whichever social media platform you now enjoy that they can listen to this. Just put the link on and stuff. It'd be nice. If your chosen podcast system does include the possibility to leave a review, do leave a review, preferably a positive one, because, you know, I don't want to hear negative stuff, basically, for Fragile Ego. And yes, otherwise, thank you very much, as always, for taking the time to listen. We will be back next time with a bit more Bosnia, so please do keep your eye out for that. Look forward to that. It is, I think, probably the most fascinating of the ending arcs, I I think, you know, from my research, compared to Croatia and Slovenia. but yes, keep it checked in. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll catch you next time.